From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Digital, analog, one-player, multiplayer, humans love games. We may not realize how much a part of our lives they are and how much Baltimore is a hub for creating games. Jonathan Moriarty, chair of a nonprofit for developers, tells us about Baltimore's booming game industry and what supports it. Micah has a game designer in residence. This year, it's Lishan AZ, who blends real life and digital in a project that explores the life of journalist Ida B. Wells. The head of Micah's game design program, Jason Karachi, says play changes our behavior.
When you're in a game, you're totally serious and you want to win or you want to engage with it or you want to be a part of it. And at the same time, you then have to walk away and not care about it, right? This is like being a good sport.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Simple, complex, digital, analog, one-player, multiplayer. Humans love games. Children play hide-and-go-seek. Teens race against their friends on video game systems. Adults fight battles on the computer with dozens of strangers. Games come in many delightful and distracting forms. Who makes them? Where do the ideas come from? Today we're looking at the game industry, particularly games that blend real world and digital aspects. What does the future of gaming hold? Jason Karachi is a game designer, artist, and chair of Maryland Institute College of Arts Game Design Program. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Lishan AZ is an artist and game creator. She is Micah's current game designer in residence. In 2017, Lishan was selected for Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 in Gaming. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jason, game design is a new undergraduate degree at Micah. How did it come about?
4 or 5 years ago, we started what we call a concentration or a minor in game design. And the truth is that Micah has a long history with game design. A lot of our alumni have gone into the industry. A lot of our alumni have started studios, both local and internationally. And so from that, we just thought it made natural sense to kind of start a program, really giving our students a better focus in the tools, the concepts, the questions about what is game design.
What are the tools and skills that you teach?
So game design encompasses a lot of different mediums, right? So it's everything from animation to illustration to graphic design to programming to producing and team management. And so we have a lot to teach in a short amount of time. We focus on the game design side of things, how the system kind of comes together. And then our students also concentrate in those other areas to build out their skills.
And what does the Game Lab do?
So the Game Lab is Micah's way to kind of have an open door for the community and for partners to work on different kinds of projects with us. So we make games, we make projects, we consult with nonprofits and other companies on how to use games and gamification in their tools and products themselves.
Give me an example.
Last year, we did a real quick consulting job with this startup called Vital Crowd. And so they're trying to change the way that we deal with clinical studies and making them more inclusive. And so one of the ways that they're trying to do that is actually to make it a little bit more fun and playful. So we actually consulted with them on how to make that possible.
And you made a game for them?
We made game elements for the ways in which the participants talk with researchers.
Huh. Lishan, you are the game designer in residence at Micah. What does that mean? What do you do?
It means that I am teaching for this year, and I'm also making projects in the game lab.
What kind of project?
Well, I'm working on two. One is a podcast-guided investigation that you're sort of like taking on the role of investigative journalist in your city. And you're sort of following along with someone that is going through their own investigation into community displacement in DC. And you're kind of mirroring their actions. So I'm sort of examining the process of having like listening to something and having that lead to like action as opposed to listening passively.
So this is tied to a podcast?
It's one in the making, yeah. It's sort of tied to a previous project that I had made in the past that was like with an installation. And then the other thing that I'm working on is kind of seeing what happens when you interject with play in spaces like buses and train stations, public transit.
Yeah, I saw that you were doing something around the MTA, the bus system, and I was just intrigued by the idea because nothing seems less fun to me than trying to commute in Baltimore. It just seems like one heartache after another. And you're making a game out of it?
Sort of not exactly a game, sort of like a playful experience. I've been starting so far with using like these interactive journals and like leaving them. I actually just came from a train station right now, so where I was doing that, having sort of these like playful prompts that are having people like interact with things that other passengers have written. And then eventually the goal is to sort of expand this and possibly bring in some digital elements, but not quite sure.
So what is the difference between designing tabletop and designing video or computer games?
You know, a lot of the fundamental skills are the same, right? You're one, thinking about a system, thinking about how people engage in the system, how that system can tell a story and create meaning between the players. Where it changes is kind of the production, right? So what does it mean to think about a system where people are interacting with it through a set of controllers, right? Or a set of an interface versus, you know, their hands and their feet and their eyes and with a bunch of cards. And so there's the production level of it. And so one of the things we do in our program is we actually start students out making tabletop games.
And tabletop means what exactly?
Everything from card games to dice games to anything that is an analog-based game is what we generally talk about tabletop. You know, something that you can play and sit around and usually playing with other people to create the system of the game. So we teach that first because it's actually the quickest way to get our students to create something and iterate on it and be able to test it without running into the wall of programming and animation and illustration. Well, they're doing some of that, but they're not doing some of the digital sides of that, which, you know, can just complicate the designs.
Some people may overlook the role games play in our culture, especially if they aren't playing games. What role do you see games playing in our culture?
I see games everywhere. I mean, I think that if you think about games just as video games, it can be really narrow. But if you think about play in a broader sense, right, you can think about sports, right? You can think about the lottery. You can think about crosswords. You can think about gambling, right? You can think about playing on a playground. You can think about just skiing, right, as a sense of play in the world. I think we as human beings, it's part instinctually of what we do and who we are. And so I think it's really important for artists and designers to be involved in kind of creating new experiences to kind of question the ways in which we play.
Lishan, one game you created builds on the work of investigative journalist Ida B. Wells, who documented lynchings of African Americans across the United States in the late 1800s. Tell us about Tracking Ida.
Yeah, so it was an alternate reality game, and my goal with it was to introduce players to non-dominant tellings of history, these stories of Black resistance, Ida B. Wells specifically, and get them excited about that history and kind of get them exposed to, you know, Ida B. Wells, she's a historical figure, but she was also an activist. And so kind of getting them exposed to the kind of activism that she was doing and getting firsthand experience in it. So there's an installation that's kind of like similar to an escape room, except the puzzles that you're solving are you're having to understand like what Ida B. Wells was writing, and the puzzles are directly linked to her articles, and everything in the game is real stories. So it starts with the story of a lynching, and you're sort of having to piece it together, and then by solving one puzzle that leads you to another compartment in the trunk that you're, and then you're solving another.
There's a trunk. Mm-hmm. The whole thing starts, the installation is a locked trunk.
Yes.
And so one of the things the players have to do is figure out how to open it.
Yes. The premise is that a descendant of a friend of Ida B. Wells finds this trunk in her grandma's attic, and that there's documents on Ida B. Wells' tactics inside, and she's preserved it there because she was under persecution. A lynch mob burned down her newspaper office in 1892. So she safeguarded her tactics inside, but you have to unlock these locks to get to it. So you're going from compartment to compartment, and each one has a different puzzle.
How did you balance making it fun and making it educational?
if I had tried to teach all of Ida B. Wells' history in one, 40-minute experience, it probably would have ended up being very unfun. But I think what I really focused on was getting people excited about history and exposing them in a way where they would learn by interacting with each other. So, for example, there's one puzzle in the game where you have two sets of headlines. One is from Ida B. Wells' newspaper, and the other is from a popular white newspaper from the same time period. And they're describing the same events, but from very different perspectives. And so in the process of solving the puzzle, you're having to have these very sensitive conversations, and you sort of realize what the press was doing at the time through interacting and having conversations with others. So I think it's... sort of having them come to the realizations instead of telling it to them.
What do you hear from students about the game?
One huge feedback was that they really enjoyed the collaboration aspect of it. Some people said that they really didn't know that people would be reporting like that, that there would be such a big difference between the perspectives in media. There's a portion of the project where people have to actually go out and conduct their own investigation, where we bring in people for them to interview. And these will be people who are directly related to police killings, sort of they're investigating lynchings in 1892 and then police killings today. So through talking to those people, players also gave a lot of feedback that it opened their eyes to what was happening in their own communities, and that they see a lot of this stuff on TV, but seeing it right there from someone who lives not that far away from them, whose son was killed not too far from their school, how that really impacted them in a different way.
Jason, you have said that games are about building empathy. What does that mean?
You're performing, you're taking part in this abstract performance, right? But what you're doing is you're actually playing with another person. You're seeing how they think, how they deal with kind of negotiating a situation, right? And from that, you can empathize a little bit better with them. I think there's something amazing about games where they are. When you're in a game, you're totally serious, and you want to win, you want to engage with it, or you want to be a part of it. And at the same time, you then have to walk away and not care about it, right? This is like being a good sport, right? And I think that there's a lesson there about being able to connect with people, and sometimes being a little bit of conflict with people, right? And then leave and be friendly and laugh and enjoy the experience of being together versus the artifice of what you're doing.
Does it sort of encourage people, without even being aware of it, to sort of let down their preconceived notions?
Yeah, that's the play, right? That's the idea that we are engaged in some level of fantasy, but, we're allowing ourselves to interact in ways that we normally would not interact, right? If we're playing a game and, even a game of tag where I'm chasing you, I normally don't run through the streets chasing people, right? That's not allowed, right,
in
society.
That.
But if I say I'm playing a game and we've all agreed we're going to play this, we're chasing each other now and we're in conflict, right? But it's not the conflict that matters. It's the amount of fun and enjoyment and kind of like the body sensations, the social sensations, the weird pacts that you make in those moments, which, make it an experience that feels alive and invigorating. And at the same time, it means nothing, right? You walk away from it and we didn't make anything, right? It's actually, we expended a lot of energy and nothing was made from it, right? But what was made were the social bonds and the ways in which we understand each other a little bit better.
Well, that's interesting because, Lishan, I wanted to ask you about some of the games you've created that have very strong social messages. A game where the participant dodges street harassment, another where the player faces the tough choices as a single mother trying to access affordable child care. I mean, those strike me as gamifying real life tough experiences, which doesn't sound like as much fun as you were just saying.
No, it's not.
So tell me about those games, Lishan.
Yes, very unfun. games also offer an opportunity to sort of show people processes or how systems work, because they are interacting with this system in your game. And so, for example, with the daycare one where the mom is looking for subsidized childcare, the player is having to sort of jump through these hoops and try to make it work. And they find by the end that they can't make it work. It's a very frustrating and very unfun game. It's not the kind of game that I play when I get together with friends, but kind of more like a tool, I guess. that kind of game.
So that's another use of games. Jason, you're working on a storytelling game that blends real life and digital play.
We've been working with this nonprofit called Artworks for Change. And so they were doing these kind of storytelling events in Africa, and they wanted to do a digital version of it. And so we've been building this app for the last 9-10 months, and it's about telling stories to one another to kind of complete these quests, but it's played on cell phones, right? But you're actually getting the quests and kind of competing on these kind of locally networked cell phones against one another as you're getting these prompts to tell these stories. So it was important for us that, you know, the people who are playing the game are all in the same space, right? Instead of looking down at your phone, you're looking at one another and the phone's prompting you to tell these stories.
What's it called?
Storylines.
What do you see as the future of gaming?
I think it's a hard question to answer because I think what we're really seeing is that gaming and games in general are moving in many different directions, right? There's people who are playing a lot of games online. There's people who are really into virtual reality games, right? There's people who are really into tabletop and collectible games. There's people who are making serious games. There's people who are doing games as art. There's people who are using games in teaching. There's people using games for medicine. We're starting to kind of realize we're playful as humans, right? And that there's a power in being able to play together. And I think what you're seeing is you're seeing artists and designers push games into lots of different areas. And what the future of that is, I don't know exactly, right? But I think this is one of the reasons why I'm excited that an art and design school like MICA is part of that conversation, because I think it's important. For a long time, video games were largely defined by the industry, right? And people trying to make money off of these things. And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, right? But it's also important to push the medium and the form in other areas. And I think that, you know, artists and designers need to be part of that conversation.
Terrific. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Karace is chair of the new game design program at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Lishan AZ is MICA's game designer in residence. Quick break now on the record. And when we come back, a look at trends in gaming, virtual reality, live streaming, and more. I'm Sheila Kass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Kass. The Entertainment Software Association, an industry group, estimates the U.S. computer and video game industry generated $30.5 billion in revenue in 2016. It's a big business that pays pretty well. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that the average salary for multimedia artists and animators is more than $63,000. You may not know that Baltimore is a hub for the game industry, home to both large firms and independent studios. Joining me to talk about the industry and the types of jobs involved in creating a video game is Jonathan Moriarty. He is a software engineer at Unit-E Technologies, a game studio in Arbutus, and he chairs the Baltimore chapter of the International Game Developers Association, a nonprofit membership organization that offers networking opportunities in professional development. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Baltimore and the surrounding region is home to lots of game companies. Why?
It started back in the 80s with a company called MicroProse that was did a lot of simulation, flight sim games, and then strategy games. And from that, MicroProse broke up and sort of everyone in there went their separate ways and started founding these other companies. The larger ones that people would probably be familiar with would be Firaxis, Big Huge Games, Breakaway. And you had people from there sort of found these different companies and then they all started making games and then it kept growing and growing. So we've got quite a robust scene at this point. I think the games people would probably recognize from the area would be Firaxis is known for XCOM and Civilization, which are popular turn-based strategy games. Further south from that, down in Bethesda, you've got the ZeniMax and Bethesda Softworks that do the Elder Scrolls series.
What are the elements in Baltimore that support this kind of business?
I think that there are a lot of academic programs locally that give people a springboard to sort of explore and get better at these sorts of things. Like I started going to college at UMBC quite unaware of the nearby industry, but one of the things that's nice about it is you'll have mentors who have industry experience who will sometimes attend different events, who can provide perspective, and organizations like the IGDA that are able to start here because there's already developers in the area. So it's one of those self-fulfilling things where, as there was this community here, it sort of was able to facilitate its own growth.
You mentioned UMBC, and we talked to some folks from MICA. Are there other educational platforms?
UMBC, MICA are both good examples. I'd say UB as well. Hopkins, I believe, is also exploring starting something up. And then, I mean, it's not uncommon for people anywhere you are to think like, wow, you know, I want to make video games. So pretty much anywhere you go, you're going to find a group of people that are at least interested in starting something.
What would you identify as trends in games right now?
I would say that right now, streaming is a big growing market, both streaming and Let's Plays, of people watching other people play games either live or pre-recorded. Technologically, you've also got virtual reality and augmented reality, which are these new platforms that facilitate different kinds of games that we maybe haven't seen before. And we've got sort of the burgeoning independent developer scene that's been growing and continues to grow, and the rise of a lot of like tool sets that facilitate people who wouldn't normally have been able to make a game to make a game. So the barrier to entry is getting sort of lower, which is a good thing.
That's Jonathan Moriarty, software engineer and chair of the Baltimore chapter of the International Game Developers Association. We're talking about Baltimore's place in the game industry and new developments in game technology. I want to pick up on what you said about streaming, live streaming. The interactive media research group Superdata estimates that the audience for online videos and live streams related to gaming is more than 650 million people worldwide, and that is larger than the audiences of Netflix, HBO, Hulu, and ESPN combined. My head spins at that estimate, but what is fun about watching someone else play video games?
There's a lot of different reasons that someone could want to watch someone play games. I think that depending upon the personality, you might be dealing with someone who's providing a comedic element to playing through it. You know, someone who's adding kind of funny commentary, kind of like wisecracking in a movie. That can be a lot of fun for some people. I think that for games that lend themselves more towards being highly competitive, games that have like an esports component, there's a performance aspect where you're just impressed to watch someone who is really that good at that game do what they do, and maybe you want to learn from them. So there's all kinds of different reasons. There's also potentially, let's say that there's a game you're on the fence about. Maybe you want to buy it, maybe you don't. You see that someone who you are aware kind of has similar opinions to yours is playing it on their stream. You can pop in, you can watch it, and you can see, like, would I like this game, would I not? So you have people that are also sort of exploring different games and providing sort of their opinions or critical analysis of it.
Does this change how games are being designed and also how they're being marketed?
Without question.
In what way?
There's certainly a lot of effort within different development studios to handle streaming in a more active way, to be a participant in that community. I would say that, for example, Firaxis does a lot of live streams where they'll have the devs present to play the game, and then they'll be sort of interacting with the community in that way, because sometimes with streams you'll have the Twitch chat. We'll take Twitch for example. You have the Twitch chat, which is people who are watching can talk to people on the stream and facilitate communication that way. I would also say that one of the bigger recent hits that kind of set people trying to figure out, you know, how to make this work is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which is a game that I think achieved sort of the wide reach that it did largely because it lends itself well to being streamed.
Before I let you go, some of our listeners may think just of animation when they think of the games you play on your phone, computer, or console. What other kinds of jobs are involved in the game industry?
Game development is sort of an interesting combination of artistic fields and technical fields. So, for example, I'm a software engineer, so I handle the game code, the actual programming that underlies the logic of the game. Depending on the largest studios, you would have specializations in that. You have people who specialize in engine code, where that's very specific, very highly mathematical rendering of things. Then for artists, you have animators, yes. You've got modelers, which handle like the construction of the actual 3D models, or sprite artists if it's a 2D game. And then you've got animators and you've got texture artists. So depending on how large or small the studio is, you can have a lot of variation in there. There's also, at larger companies, producers that will manage schedules and kind of make sure that things are on track to hit milestones. And then you've also got, outside all of that, you have game designers that design how these systems should work, whereas a programmer would implement them. Their job is usually to implement sort of a concept or a prototype version and be iterating on it constantly to try and figure out what works best, what's the most fun, what will work best for the goals we set, what's achievable.
Thanks for the overview. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jonathan Moriarty is a software engineer at Unit-E Technologies, a game studio in Arbutus. He chairs the Baltimore chapter of the International Game Developers Association. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.